Salaamu Alaikum. Peace be upon you. And I wish I could say that in French as well, but I'm very limited. I know bonjour. That's about it. But nice to see you all. I noticed that in the introduction, inshallah is the same in both English and French. My daughters, I have to share this with you. My daughters were growing up. You know, whenever they would ask my wife for something, you know, an ice cream cone or let's go to the store or something, she would always say, inshallah, inshallah. And so after a while, whenever she used to say that, like, Mommy, can we get an ice cream cone? She would say, inshallah. They'd always go, why not? Well, but that's sort of a little bit of the subject that I want to talk about today. And that is about raising Muslim children in the United States of America and Canada, and some of the difficulties involved with that. So this is one of my most unpleasant lectures to deliver. And tomorrow I get to deliver, talk about something that I enjoy talking about much more. But I think it's an important topic. So, but bear in mind that I really don't know much about the Canadian Muslim scene. I'm much more familiar with the American Muslim scene. And much of what I might say today may not exactly apply to things in Canada, in particular in Quebec. So don't get angry at me if what I say, is not such a big issue here. What I'm basically sharing with you, the difficulties and problems that I believe we encounter more in, primarily in the United States with raising our children. All right? Did you follow that? But if I were to ask you, any of you, even those of you who have some experience with the American, and by American I mean Canadian and, or the United States, or both communities, Muslim communities, if I were to ask you, where do most of the Muslims, citizens, and permanent residents in North America come from? I'd be sure if I went throughout this audience and asked that question, I'd get a variety of answers. If you visited Silicon Valley in California, you would certainly say, oh, India and Pakistan. I've actually tried that in that area. And that's almost everybody says, oh yeah, most of the American Muslims, permanent residents and citizens are from India and Pakistan. If I asked you that in northern St. Louis, you would probably say, Eastern Europe. Bosnia and some of the other Balkan countries. If I asked that same question in Kansas City, people familiar with the Kansas City community would say, oh, the Arab world. And so forth and so on. If I asked you in southwest San Francisco, you would say, oh, the Fiji Islands. But the common denominator, I think, or maybe the least common multiple, I've got to think about that for a second. But the common denominator to all those answers, I think, is that if you ask most people that have some knowledge of the American Muslim community, if you ask them where do most of the citizens and permanent residents come from, the answer would be overseas. The answer would be they're immigrants. But that cannot possibly be the case. And I want to explain to you why. Let's just take the American scene. The United States scene. In the United States, the estimates are that there are somewhere between, 2 million and 8 million. Now the estimates by the Muslim community are up to 10 million, 11 million, escalating very fast. But the estimates vary to how many Muslim permanent residents and citizens live in America, because the census doesn't record that data. But the most moderate estimates, and the ones we'll take it, as sort of a median estimate, is 5 million. Let's say there are 5 million Muslim permanent residents and citizens in the United States of America. So let's try to figure out just sort of roughly how many of those are from overseas. Well, during the 50s and 60s and 70s, and even thereafter, there was a massive large-scale conversion to Islam in America. Many African American brothers and sisters first went through the Nation of Islam, not all of them did, but that was the majority, embraced the Nation of Islam's teachings under Elijah Muhammad, but the great majority of those brothers and sisters followed the same path blazed by Malcolm X and Warafin Muhammad and came over to mainstream Islam. Now, at the height of the Nation of Islam, when Malcolm X was recruiting so successfully, they had a million members, a million on their membership list. Now, most of those brothers and sisters eventually came over to mainstream Islam, and then there's been a steady influx of Muslims from that same community, the African-American community, ever since. We can be sure that there are somewhere in the neighborhood at least of a million African-American converts to Islam in America. The majority of them came through the Nation of Islam experience, but certainly not all. So right there you have a million homegrown American Muslims. But in the 70s and 80s and 90s and since, we've had quite a few converts from other ethnicities in America, a steady trickle, as they said in the Time Magazine article. Time Magazine article estimated back in the early 80s that there were somewhere near 5,000 converts per year from other ethnicities. Less than 30 years since, there have been another 150,000 converts at least, and the rate of conversion has been increasing. So, but let's just say a million, 1.2 million converts to Islam in America. And a lot of researchers, non-Muslim researchers, think that's a low estimate. But let's take that as an estimate. 1.2 million, just to be a conservative size, a million converts. So that's already a significant number of homegrown American Muslims. But now, let's count the children. The children, those who are born in the United States but of Muslim parentage. Now, Muslim families Muslims started immigrating to the United States. There were big waves back in the early 1900s and around 1950. But the most recent wave of immigration started in 1970, 80, 90, 2000, up till now, the last 50 years. So by now, there should be second and third generation, even fourth generation Muslims in America from that latest wave of immigration. Now, the average Muslim in America lives in a family. The average Muslim family in America has what size? What do you think the average size is? Well, the average American family is 4.25 people. But Muslim families tend to have more children than the national demographic. And I think if we said 3, that would really be a low estimate for the number of children in the average American Muslim family. I have 3 children. We have one of the smallest families in the Muslim community in Lawrence. So let's just say 3 children. 3 children in a family of 5. That's 3 out of 5. 3 out of 5 members born in the USA. Now there are 5 million Muslims in America. 3/5 of them are probably descendants of Muslims born in the USA, not counting later generations. 3/5 of 5 million is 3 million. Throw back in the lowball estimate of a million American converts. 3 million plus 1 million is 4 million. 4 million out of 5 million is 80%. But I can guarantee you, if you go to any masjid in America, almost any Friday prayer, or any Muslim function in America, I defy you to find anywhere near 80% or even 60%, maybe my estimate is high, or 50% or 40%, even 10%. I defy you to find anywhere near that kind of percentage representation. Most masjids in America, you go to the Friday prayer. I don't know how it is here in Canada, but in the United States, you go to the Friday prayer, you'll be lucky if you find a handful of second or third or fourth generation Muslims in attendance. At Lawrence, Kansas, we're in the middle of the country, not too far from Kansas City, which has a sizable Muslim community. Lawrence itself is estimated to have 2,000 to 3,000 Muslim permanent residents and citizens. If you go to the Friday prayer in Lawrence, and we have a large number of children up on campus, students on campus that have Muslim parents in different parts of the country, you know how many of those kids come to the Friday prayer in Lawrence, Kansas? You can usually count them on one hand. You can usually count them on one hand. Two, three, four. And I'll tell you the truth, all of them that come have families that live in Lawrence and that come to the Friday prayer. Now we estimate based on the population centers that feed our university, our enrollment, that the percentage of Muslims or percentage of students in Lawrence, Kansas, that are Muslim parentage, that have at least one Muslim parent, is somewhere between 1% and 2% of the student population. Population is 30,000. That means 300 to 600 students on campus, we estimate, to be born in the United States of America with at least one Muslim parent. And we are only getting four to show up to our community functions. Four out of somewhere between 300 and 600. And as I travel around the country, some communities are doing a little better, some are actually doing a little worse, if you can believe it. But throughout the country, the one thing we are noticing consistently is the great, great absence of homegrown American Muslims, even though they're in the majority. There's a great absent majority of Muslims in America. You know, some parents, they say, well, they'll come back when they're in their 20s or 30s or 40s. You know, they'll come back later on. But so far, history has shown that not to be the case. Those immigrants that came in pretty large waves in the first half of the last century, their total was somewhere around 100,000 immigrants from 1900 to 1950 from Muslim countries came to America. By now, those immigrants have third or fourth generation descendants. Again, they tended to originally have large families. You could imagine two Muslim parents coming in 1920 having what? Four, five, six, seven children, each of them having their children, and et cetera, et cetera. By now, that same family should have a family tree of 30, 40 individuals. Times 100,000 is 4 million. Where are those 4 million descendants? We don't see them. They're long gone. Sometimes you meet them. Sometimes I give lots of lectures throughout the United States. Sometimes somebody will come up to me and say, you know, my great-great-grandfather was a Muslim. Or, you know, my great-grandparents on this side of my family, they were Muslim. They've been completely absorbed into society, and Islam is something long in their past. In the past 50 years, there has been a large-scale, steady flow of immigrants to America from Muslim countries. And although the Muslim community has created many American Muslim institutions, like the Canadian Islamic Congress, for example, and MSA, and ICNA, and ISNA, and ANC, and CARE, MPAC, and so forth and so on, the religion has not really taken root in America. Because crucial to the vitality of any religious community is its ability to engage and attract converts and or descendants. Any community that cannot attract its converts and engage them or its descendants has to continually rely on immigration to sustain it. And such a community cannot rightfully be said to be really rooted in the society. So the question is, where have all the indigenous Muslims gone? Where have all the homegrown Muslims gone? This is a major, major question. You'd think it would be on the front page of every Muslim publication in America. You'd think that it would be the main topic, the principal theme, at Islamic conferences. But time and time again, the issue is not discussed. It might be alluded to here and there, an oblique remark that seems to refer to this problem, but you don't see any real major effort to discuss this. And I really don't know why. Now, to be honest with you, brothers and sisters, I'm sort of worn out talking about it, because it just seems like something our community doesn't want to discuss. And I often say that when I'm invited to a community to discuss the subject, I'm usually invited once. I get an invitation later, please don't give that lecture again, could you talk about something else? Talk about the purpose of life, or talk about their conversion experience, or, you know, talk about this and that, something to cheer us up. It is, you know, a serious problem. And for Muslims, those who have, you know, deep faith in their religion, it's a major problem because in the Quran especially, it informs us, it says, save your children and your families, save yourselves and your families from a fire whose fuel is men and stones. You know, from a fire for whom we ourselves are the fuel for that anguish that we suffer in the next life of the false object of worship symbolized by stones. But it says, save yourself and your families. And your family. And it's addressed to the community in the plural. Just doesn't mean you go out and save your own family. It's how to go out there and work, to engage, and to address the next generation. But in any case, where have they gone? Tell you the truth, I noticed their absence from the day I first became a Muslim, but I had no clue. I had no clue where they are. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much. But what happened was something very interesting. You know, it was just, you know, some would say chance, you know. I was sitting in the masjid one night in San Francisco. That's where I became a Muslim, and I was much loving the experience of being a convert to Islam. That first year and a half, and I was a Muslim, the masjid was my sanctuary. I went to it five times every day. I moved close to campus, so I could do that. It was a beautiful, mesmerizing experience attending the masjid. And one day, after the camaraderie and the brethrenship, it's really something else. And since I came from a somewhat dysfunctional family, it was great having all this love from fellow community members. So I became extremely attached to the mosque. And one night, we're sitting in the masjid, sitting in a circle like we always did after the Eshel prayer, talking and chatting. And then Muhammad, who's the oldest member of our community, he's about 40-something. He's from the Middle East. He informs us, as we're sitting in a circle, he says, brothers, my oldest boy turned 16 today. Now, Muhammad was the oldest member of our community, and his son was the oldest of the next generation. And we all start laughing, congratulating him, and, you know, praising him, etc. But his eyes were cast down to the carpet. And when he lifted them slowly, we saw big, round teardrops dropping down his cheeks, making their way down his cheeks slowly. We all got quiet. And he looked at us and he said, brothers, I lost him. I've lost my son. And we knew what he was talking about. We saw it in the surrounding communities time and time again. You know, Muhammad was a religious man. And he did his best to raise his child as he was raised. Somehow, he felt he had lost his son. And by the, when I left San Francisco, you know, his son still wasn't one back to the community. And a lot of times when we lose them, it's very hard to win them back. So, as I drove home from the masjid that night, I was haunted by the image of Muhammad's face. Because I just had the good news a couple of months earlier that my wife was pregnant with our first child, who would turn out to be a daughter. And I was wondering, as I was driving back to the masjid that night, well, 16 years from now, will I too be looking at the fellow members of my community with that same vacant, defeated expression on my face? And so I started writing. I began writing, according to my experiences of what it was like to be an American convert to Islam in the United States of America, assuming that somehow my children might relate to my experience. Figuring that we're both from the United States of America, the difficulties and problems that I face, they might be able to relate to them. and there might be some help in that. So I wrote my first book, which I entitled I entitled it Struggling to Surrender. I wrote it for my children. And I left it on my shelf in a manuscript form for my children. But my friends used to come over and want to read it, and I lend it to them, and they read it. And finally, they kept saying, Jeff, you've got to try to publish this. You've got to try to publish it. So I did, and it got published. And then something interesting happened. I began receiving emails from converts from the United States and Canada. Not emails. That time, email, Al Gore hadn't invented it. I began receiving letters and telephone calls and other forms of communication of converts mostly, saying that they very much, back in those days, of course not everybody could relate to my experience, some had very different experiences, but I received many, many emails of converts sharing similar experiences, feeling that they relate to mine. And I noticed from our communications that the many, many converts that I communicated with are paths to Islam and our paths thereafter intersected at many key points. And based on that, I wrote another book for my children, and I called it Even Angels Ask. And a large part of it is devoted to theology, the theological type of questions that drive many Americans, not just Muslims, from belief in God. And I try to describe what kind of answers many of us have found in the Quran. And again, my friends encouraged me to publish it. I ended up publishing it. It came out. And then something remarkable happened. I began receiving emails, mostly emails, because now it was email generation. I began receiving email after email after email after email from young people in America and Canada who were struggling with their faith, young Muslims. A large number of them, a good percentage, said they had already left the faith. They weren't Muslims anymore. Many felt they were on the verge of leaving the faith. Almost all of them felt they were in a crisis, a faith crisis. It was an interesting sample. It's not your average American Muslim person who was emailing me. Most American Muslim young people growing up there have no connection to the religion aside from the fact they know it's in their heritage. Most of them come from families that are disconnected from the mosque, so they don't really feel the need to become connected to it. Most of them, the whole idea of religion is on the shelf. This is a much more intense crowd. These were people, many of them, that grew up in religious families and that were struggling with their religion. These were people that had become atheists, but still were tormented to the extent that they needed to double check things. It was an interesting group. And I began to record these communications. I opened a file, and began to put them in there. And the file of those communications quickly grew to 100 pages, and then 200 pages, and then 300 pages, so I reduced the font size, then 400 pages, 500 pages, and now over 1,300 pages long. And based on those communications, I wrote my next book, which was called Losing My Religion, A Call for Help. Because one of the emails I received was entitled, Losing My Religion, A Call for Help. So I changed the file to that name. Because I felt that this was a very important perspective that our community should be aware of. This is vital information. Because if we want to know why these young people aren't coming, it's not like they're going to come knocking on the door and tell us. It's a very hard group. Most of them will never share their experiences with their parents. Time and time again, I would get these emails, and I stopped doing this. But the first few years, I would invariably email them back and say, why don't you discuss this with your parents? Why don't you discuss this with your local imam? Why don't you discuss this with a religious leader in your community? And they would send me back things like, are you crazy, Dr. Lai? They would totally freak out. I would be disinherited. My father would kill me. My parents would say, I shamed the entire family and all every generation of it because I went and talked to your mom about these questions. So I realized that we had a major crisis on the hand. We have young people in crisis, in a faith crisis, who had nowhere to go to. I mean, the very fact that they were seeking out some obscure author in the very middle of the United States of America, in a small Muslim community, in an isolated area, tells you just how desperate their situation was. So, I think it's an important perspective, because if these people, who have enough concern to actually seek out somebody to help them with their problem, had these problems, you could be sure that the much greater number of second-generation Muslims who have nothing to do with the religion, have no concern with it, if they were to encounter the community, if they were to try to participate in the community, they would have very similar problems. So I wrote that book. I didn't know what was going to happen to it, and that's an interesting story, but I'm not going to tell you that. Today I'm just going to share with you what was shared with me. Let's see, what time is it? 5-0, is that right? 8-0, 7-0? Is that right? 9-0, thank you. Okay, so I'll take about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, to share with you what they shared with me. Don't stone the messenger. And then I'll talk about 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes, how we might approach that, and then I guess we can discuss it after. You know, I wish I had all the answers. I don't. But I think these are important issues and they need to be talked about. We need to be aware of it. It needs to be moved up to the front of our community's agenda at meetings and conferences and publications and so forth. Well, where have all these children gone? What kind of problems did they present to me? Well, one, top of the list, believe it or not, oh, you'll probably believe it. Top of the list is, of course, culture clash. The clash between the mosque culture, the culture of the mosque, and the surrounding society. And chief thing, the principal item in this category, of course, was the treatment of women in their local Muslim community. The treatment of women. Here's some of what they shared with me. Many of these young people complained that, and they usually said that Islam does these things. They didn't say the community does these things, or the community, this happens in the community, they'd email me and say, Islam makes it this way. So they all very often identified these things with Islam because they were told that these things were Islam, or were demanded by Islam. They said women were discouraged from attending the congregational prayers, the five daily prayers. They said that women were placed in secluded, separate areas away from the main prayer hall so that they would be secluded from the men. And for many of them, this was a major problem. The seclusion of women in their communities was a major problem. In Lawrence, Kansas, for example, we have a masjid with a nice, big, expansive prayer area for the men, with beautiful lighting, and brand new doors, wonderful windows have been constructed. It used to be a church and a school. And they did a beautiful job in the men's prayer area. But the women's prayer area, you have to go up two or three flights of stairs. I can't remember because I've never been there. But you have to go up two or three flights of stairs and then down a hallway, I remember, and then through this little corridor and down this dark corridor. And then you finally come to the women's prayer area, which is small, dark, and poorly maintained with lead paint, you know, chipping from the walls. Electrical outlets exposed. The ladies have been complaining about the condition of the place. The paint is old. The carpet smells. The ventilation is poor. And nothing's being done about it. We've got fundraisers to renovate the mosque. And so far, around $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 has been raised. But you know where all that money has gone. Renovating the men's area. Not a dime has been spent on the women's area yet. It's amazing. And you know, I used to pray with my daughters every night in the message, my three daughters. They were little, of course, so it didn't attract much attention, but Jamila would be the oldest. She was 3 or 4 in Lawrence at the time, and she'd be scampering around all over the place exploring, and Sarah would be clinging to my pants. Fatman was too small, so I'd be holding her in my arms, but it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. As the years went by, that became our nightly routine. Of course, I bribed them a little. I always took them out for ice cream after or something. But I really think they loved going to the masjid almost as much as I did, and almost as much as I loved having them there. But as they got older, some of the, you know, rumors started to fly, and people used to make hints, and, you know, tell me, you know, they're getting a little Jeff, they should be praying with them upstairs in the dungeon. Well, they didn't call me that. But the point is that little by little my daughter is starting to get, I used to try to protect them from that. Because, of course, during the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, the women used to pray in the same courtyard as men in Medina. And there were no barriers or separations or things like that. So I didn't feel the need to have them go somewhere else. They got older, they just prayed at their little line of three. They enjoyed it, but there were the stares, there were the uncomfortable glances, there were the remarks to my wife sent through other women, so forth and so on. They got, little by little, they got to know about it, and they gave the ladies' prayer area a try. But going back up there in the dark at night, through the hallways, alone in that dark and dingy area, it wasn't very comforting to them, and it destroyed the whole experience. But the long and the short of it is my children haven't been to the masjid to pray in about 8 years. I'm not saying they're not Muslims. But I've come to realize that most likely their experience of Islam in America is going to be very different from mine. My experience has always been a community experience. It's an experience of faith community. Their experience is going to be one of practicing Islam in virtual isolation. And I wonder what their chair, you know, how it's going to affect everything. Their whole life, their future, their commitment to the faith, their children. Links to the religion. It's a big issue. The young people also shared with me that women are denied positions of leadership in most communities in America. Not everywhere, but in many communities, it's true. I went to a community in New Jersey not just long ago. I said, do you know that 4 or 5 years ago I came to a community and they wouldn't allow women to vote in the election? Community election. And then like 15 ladies raised their hands in the audience. We can't vote in our election. It still happens to this day. Women are denied positions on boards of directors or executive committees in many communities. And women converts, I'm trying to rush through some of these, the most visible group of converts to Islam in America, claim, I don't know if this is true, I'm not part of the women's group. The most visible group of converts to Islam in America, and the women are much more tenacious in hanging on to this religion than their male counterparts. It's amazing. A friend of mine, Lynn Jones, wrote about that in her book, how they cling to this religion, many of them, by their fingernails. But they claim, at least the ones that emailed me, that they are often ignored, derided, disrespected, marginalized, and disenfranchised in their communities. At least they feel they have been. They claim they're treated like less than second-class citizens in their own countries. And, of course, that hurts. It doesn't help. That's your fake experience. You have to contend with that. Now, the situation is more complicated than that. Because after I wrote my book, I heard from Muslim ladies that were born overseas, they said, no, that's not the problem. The problem is that the men respect the lady converts more than they do the immigrant Muslim lady, and there's resentment forming and things like that. Maybe all that is true. I don't know what the complexities of it is or the dynamics, but when you have these sort of problems, you have problems. Because if the ladies don't come to the mosque, then the children won't come to the mosque. And if the children don't come to the mosque, they're going to have a hard time getting connected to it when they're not children anymore. Now, if you want to get your children in the mosque, if you have any hope of having them form a viable, heartfelt connection to the mosque, you have to start early. The ladies don't come to the mosque, most of the children. A lot of them describe in their communities what they call the status ladder. A lot of the ladies describe it this way. In every Muslim community, you have two ladders. There's the men's ladder, and status is sort of determined by a number of things, but, you know, mostly, they said, ethnicity. So if Muslims come from one background, male Muslims come from one background, they're at the top of the ladder. By the way, they said, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white American converts are immediately pushed to the top. Unless they sort of rock the boat and start questioning things, then they fall down the ladder. But then after that, in a certain ethnicity, then, you know, you have this, and they sort of go down the ladder. But then at the bottom of the ladder, then you have the women's ladder begin. And they say that the women's ladder also has these ethnic sort of divisions, but it also has this kind of division, that a woman's credibility, is Muslim credibility, is sort of inversely proportional to how long she has lived in the United States. Inversely proportional, you know what I mean? So that the shorter the lady has lived here, the more credibility she has, more respect she has. So those that just got off the plane, maximum Islamic respect. You know, people look to her, or, you know, she's untainted by the Western society. And then those who have lived longer, a little less, you know, and then longer and longer, and then down towards the bottom of the ladder, then comes the next generation. And then below the next generation comes the convert. At least that's the way the ladies perceive it. I don't know if it is true. I don't know if it is true. Like I said, I've never been a part of the ladies' community and my community. But if that is the perception, then there's a major problem. You know, they need to be addressed. I could go on and on and talk about the issues that were presented to me about women, but for the lack of time, I'm going to move ahead. A lot of our young people claim that there's an intellectual divide. They're like, they have to develop a certain intellectual schizophrenia to negotiate the mosque culture and then the larger culture. They say that they have to think one way in the Muslim community, and then they have to shift and think another way in their schooling and in their education and their jobs. You know, they have to adopt kind of like a double think. You know, and sometimes it drives them nuts, because, you know, sometimes it's not always easy to shift from one to the other. They say in the American community, these are some of the things that were said, in the American community, great emphasis is put on rationalism. And they claim, well, in the Muslim community, great emphasis is put on traditionalism, following the tradition, not rocking the boat. Don't question, especially if the questions are difficult to answer. That question is haram. It's haram to ask that question. You can't ask that question, and you're not a Muslim. But what if I really have that question? Well, then you better get rid of it. But I can't get rid of it because I can't answer it. Well, then you're not Muslim. Just put it out of your mind. Some of them actually email me to describe these kind of dilemmas. I remember when I first became a Muslim, I thought I would share with my community my experience. Of course, my experience was I was an atheist with all these objections to the existence of the idea of God, the idea of the existence of God. All merciful, divine creators. And then I had all these objections, and I read the Quran, and it answered my questions for me. So I would give stand in front of an audience like this one, in a mess theater somewhere, and start to explain it. And I would begin by presenting the questions I had that led me to disbelieve in God. And I tell you the truth, brothers and sisters, I'd get halfway through the questions, and brothers would start standing up and say, "This is haram." It's haram to even consider these questions. I told them, I'm going to tell you what came next. No, it was that way. But of course, that was back in 1982. You know, things have progressed a little bit since then. But for many of our children, it is still that way. They have a question, "You're a kafir." Don't ask that question. Don't you dare go to the imam with that question. Everybody in the community will say, "My children are kafirs." They say that a larger society promotes individualism, celebrates the maverick who goes out there and blazes the trail, challenges tradition, thinks outside the box. They say the Muslim community puts great emphasis on strict conformance to community norms and standards. Don't rock the boat. Don't stand out. Just keep a low profile, unless you're going to represent an overall point of view. I could go on with this. Critical objective research is emphasized in one community, promoted in one community, adherence to the ancient authorities. I'm not saying these things are, one is bad and one is good. Just saying that for a lot of our kids, they feel that they're caught in an intellectual dilemma. Free speech and freedom of thought is celebrated in the United States of America and Canada. Of course, in the United States of America, under George Bush, it's almost meaningless now. But free speech and freedom of thought is still much celebrated in the United States of America. In the masjid, our young people complain that there are some very severe limitations on speech and thought. A lot of communities, you got to get, before you can even say something in the masjid, you got to get permission from the leadership, and they have to know what you're going to say, and so forth, and so on. You know? All speech and thought is very strictly controlled, as it is in many third world oligarchies, for example. But in any case, many of our kids, for these are problems. Let me just summarize it rather than go down the intellectual doublethink that many of our young people complain of and our converts. Basically, the idea is this. Many of our young people, they're not scholars of Islam. They're not university professors that are going to go out and start exploring and reading, going through ancient texts and things like that. Most of them are just kids, and they are basing, and as they're growing up in America, they are weighing these two communities side by side. And they are intuitively trying to figure out which one makes more sense. And by and large, they are seeing the mainstream culture with all its faults and flaws. They're still seeing the mainstream culture as democratic, inclusive, tolerant, encourages mutual respect and objectivity, where arguments are won by rational thought. In contrast, many of them see their mosques as totalitarian, exclusivist, shutting out points of view that don't agree with the leadership, intolerant, patronizing, oppressive, and where proof and arguments are won by intimidation and threat. That's the way they're seeing it. And many of them think that this religion just doesn't make sense. And like I said, they associate it with Islam. And they email me, "Well, Islam requires this." And I have to email them back and say, "Are you sure that Islam requires that?" That's how deeply confused they are. Because ever since they were kids, they were told Islam requires this, Islam requires that. Let me give you an example of the type of concrete examples they give me. One young lady said, "My dad doesn't have a clue how I'm going to get married someday." She said, "My dad tells me that if I see one of my classmates in a mall or something like that, or out on the street when I'm with my family, and he's a non-Muslim, it's okay if I go up and talk to him. He'll say hello and things like that. If he's a Muslim, I can't talk to him. On the other hand, he tells me at the same time that if he's a non-Muslim, I can't marry him, but if he's a Muslim, I have to marry him. So she said, here it is, you know, the boys that I have no chance of marrying, I can talk to them, but the boys that I'm supposed to marry, I could never talk to them. Another young lady wrote me and she said, you know, I mean, it's really strange, you know, they keep us so separated from each other in the chaperoned environment of the community. They keep us so segregated from one another and secluded from one another that we virtually have no contact with Muslims of the opposite gender. She said, so what happens is, in reality, for every 1 minute of contact I have with a Muslim male who someday I'm supposed to marry from among them, I have 1,000 minutes of inadvertent contact with non-Muslim males who I'm not supposed to marry someday. She said, is it any wonder that Muslim girl after Muslim girl is falling in love with non-Muslim boys? 1,000 to 1. And it says in the Quran that God has put, you know, a mutual attraction between the sexes, you know, in human nature, etc. It's magnetism. And drawing them together. She said, what do they expect? Well, a young boy wrote me. He said to me, my dad is a social schizophrenic. When he's at the masjid and he sees a female fully covered, dressed modest as can be, he sees them, is shocked, and immediately turns around and faces the opposite direction. And then at work, on the Thanksgiving holiday, he always has a special day where they celebrate, you know, Thanksgiving at work. And he's invited us, of course, his family to go to that. And he's putting his arm around ladies, talking to them, chatting, etc., the non-Muslim lady. Why does my dad find a Muslim lady fully dressed more threatening to morality than a non-Muslim lady in a short skirt at a Thanksgiving party? You know, in an open environment. And they're starting to say, this just doesn't make sense. And I can give you an example after example after example. Think if you're a young kid growing up in America, and you're comparing these two things side by side. Of course, you don't talk to your parents about it, because they'll, if these kids are right, freak out. So what do? You just keep it to yourself and wait for the time when you're old enough to start deciding what your own lifestyle is going to be. Keep it to yourself. You let just live with these doubts. If you're crazy, you email Jeff Lang in Lawrence, Kansas. I received 2 emails today, by the way, and asked him to help you with your problems. And I'll tell you the truth, I don't feel up to the challenge most of the time. This takes community effort. It's only so many minutes in the day. There's so much reading I could do. And I wasn't born in the Middle Eastern culture. I don't even understand it. I understand the Western culture. That's all I know. That's where I grew up. And I tell you the truth, things that are obvious from a Middle Eastern point of view or from a Far Eastern point of view are not obvious from a Western point of view. I say to my brothers and sisters, why do you think that's essential to Islam? They give me this argument. I go, that just doesn't make sense. Why? Because I'm thinking from a different cultural experience. But in any case, these are some of the things our young people are grappling with. You see, psychologists these days talk very frequently about identity formation. It's a critical phase we all go through, identity formation. As we're going through our life, we're choosing what we're going to put in our identity basket, what we're going to identify ourselves with. Oh yeah, I like to be identified with my mom's Middle Eastern cooking. Okay, yeah, my friend did, and so forth. Yeah. I like to be identified as somebody of this background. I like to be identified in this way and that way. I like to be identified as a smart student. I like to be identified as a woman, and so forth and so on. You know, we constantly are making those choices throughout our life, but especially it reaches its most chaotic and difficult period with adolescence. And what happens is, as kids reach that stage, you know, it's a very tumultuous part of their life where they're very quickly making major identity choices, what they identify with or not. For kids of immigrant background, that identity crisis is usually much greater, much more intense. For kids of Muslim immigrant background, it could be even much, much more intense. But here's what happens. Basically, the idea is this. To come from two cultures simultaneously, you try to pick, psychologists have shown this, you try to pick things that fit well in both cultures, of course, easily in both cultures. And then the things that are harder to fit in, you have a more difficult time dealing with. And things that are on the extremes from one culture's point of view or the other, a lot of times kids tend to ignore or leave out. Are you following me? So if kids go to their messages and they find them to be extreme or nonsensical or irrational from the other point of view, their other point of view, juggling two identities at once, two basic baskets at once, they tend to stay away from them. And so in Lawrence, Kansas, at the beginning of every semester, we have this phenomenon. Converts enter the religion. A lot of them burn out after 6, 8, 9 months, 2 years, whatever. I'm not saying all of them. I'm saying a lot of them. We've had 34 converts in the last 5 years. Right now, two of them still go to a mosque. But that doesn't mean they all left the religion. Some have moved away. But still, many of them still live in Lawrence, and they have nothing to do with the community. But it takes them a while. Our young people, they come to the mosque, they're on the university campus for the first time, they've never been to the mosque, they have Muslim parents, or one Muslim parent, they go down and give it a try on the first day of classes, they come to the first Friday prayer, they attend it, we never see them again. Visceral counter-reaction. Visceral rejection. It's too painful. Then a lot of our young people, other issues, theology, the purpose of life. Growing up in the United States of America or Canada, they sit, drink coffee with their friends, and they're of a different religion, so the issue of religion and theology often comes up. It's a big talking point for kids in America, especially high school and college age. And somebody asks them, what does your religion see as the purpose of life? I don't know, God created us to worship him. Why does your God need to worship? Well, he actually created us because Adam sinned, so he punished everybody for Adam's sin. Why does he put us here to suffer? Why didn't he just pop us into heaven? Why didn't he just make us angels if he wants us to surrender to his will? These are the kinds of questions they face. They're foundational in the Western cultural experience. These are the questions that have helped to shape secular Western culture. So they're going to encounter them. So they go back to the mosque for answers. Ones that will work when they're discussing with their friends, if they go back to the mosque at all. A lot of them just give up. But those are the type of questions I get time and time again. So I always include the first chapter of my books is usually about those theological questions. Many of them are suspicious of the Islamic sciences. I'll give you an example, the Hadith literature. Young person goes to the mosque, Friday prayer, hears a hadith, shakes the foundations of his faith, so then he starts looking into the matter. Goes to the library. He's at a university, goes to the university library, starts researching this, and what does he find? Oh, tons and tons of research in English has been done on this great science. But almost all of it, we kindly request you to pause for a moment while we change the audio tape. Order in the court. Are you ready? Order in the court. Are you ready? And the Hadith literature is just one example, but they go to the university library. and they find that almost all the work that they can find in English written on it is written by Western scholars or non-Muslim scholars. Some of them from Japan, some of them from all over the world, but they're almost entirely written by non-Muslims. I'm not saying the research is bad. Actually, much of it is very, very good. But there is a certain bias, and it lacks a Muslim perspective. But the sad thing is, Muslims are not contributing to that intellectual effort. They're not making their point of view known. They don't even know about modern methods of research in those areas, most of them, the vast majority of our scholars. They're even unaware of it. They're totally in the dark. And so the answers that they could give to these young kids with their questions in this domain are just not even in the ballpark. If you're a Muslim scholar and you want to help our children, you have to be conversant in the type of literature that they are going to encounter when they research Islam. Where else? Where else do our young people go? And that's why we need you sitting here today, you young people sitting here today. For those of you who have the inclination, that's why we need you to enter the fields of religious studies and Middle Eastern studies, etc., so you can master those modes of research and thought and evaluate that research and separate what you feel is strong and for what is weak and help your fellow generations and future generations to come. Where else do they look if they have questions? I'll tell you where they look, because I get this in my emails all the time. Dr. Lyon, I had this question about women in Islam. And I, you know, looked, went to the library, couldn't find much, so where did I go? Where do they always go? The internet. The internet generation. They have a question, so they go to Google, and they hit women in Islam, and then whatever their particular issue is. Click. And they go to several hundred websites. They're taken to several hundred websites. And once again, the vast majority of them in English are by non-Muslims. But these are not, by and large, people that are researchers who are trying to strive for some objectivity in their work. These are mostly non-Muslims who are propagandists who are trying to present a loathsome image of Islam. More than 9 times out of 10, our kids, when they go to those websites, they read the arguments, they see the sources that are used to build those arguments against the religion, and they are shook. So I get emails, Dr. Lang, you've got to go to this website. It's about 20, 30 pages long, but you got to go in there and refute everything that they said. I get one of those emails every couple weeks. If I did nothing else 24 hours a day, I would just be working on websites. We're going from one after the next. No, we have to educate our children and teach them how to think, how to think critically, how to approach these type of questions on their own, how to do the kind of research necessary so that they can answer their own questions. We have to bring them up to think. Many of them are unconfident of traditional Islamic law. I mentioned it a lot of times. That's just because they're associating things that the masjid tells them is demanded by the religion with their religion. And they assume that this is commanded by Islam, or it's required by Islamic law. A lot of times, it's highly debatable. Scholars have very, very diverse opinions on that particular subject. A lot of times, it has nothing to do with Islamic law at all. It's more a cultural tradition. One other issue, and I don't think this is an issue in Canada, but it certainly is in the United States, because Canada to me is, I always envision it as this idyllic, wonderful, diverse, politically correct, harmonious tapestry of different cultures. I guess you're laughing, so I guess I'm wrong. Actually, when I was 26 and finished graduate school, I was desperate to move to Canada. It's right after, you know, not too long after Vietnam, pretty much sick to living in America at the time, and I saw my country going in a very bad direction. So I thought, go to Canada. So much of what I say about this may not apply here, but
A big problem we have in the American Muslim community, in the United States Muslim community, is this major ethnocentrism. So if you go to the mosque in San Francisco, for example, you have masjids that are actually named by cultural background. That's the Pakistani mosque. That's the Indian mosque. That's the Yemeni mosque. That's the Syrian mosque. That, and so forth and so on. We even have a Fiji mosque. Our kids say, well, we're like this big dysfunctional family. We can't get along. And converts sometimes enter that and go, what is going on here? Because each mosque promotes, it's in the name of Islam, its peculiar perspective. I talk about this longer, but I'll just give you one very critical example. This one I don't think this could be a problem up here. But in the American Muslim community, well, let me explain it with an example. When I became a Muslim, but this is about ethnocentrism, but one particular type. When I became a Muslim, about 2 weeks after I became a Muslim, I was invited to UC Davis to hear this great lecturer speak on Islam. So when I got there, I'm nervous and I'm anxious to hear the speaker. I notice we're running a little late, as usually at Muslim meetings, because we're usually on our shuttle time. But 15, 20 minutes go by, and then we finally start. And we start, and the speaker gets up there, the master of arms, master of ceremony, and he says that reads from the Quran, now we're ready, makes a supplication, reads from the Quran, now we're ready for our speaker. Dr. Lang, would you please come up to the microphone and tell us your experience of coming to this? Did he say my name? Some man, I'm put on the spot. I felt like spotlight had come up. Did he say my name? I looked to Rossley, who's a student of mine at the University of San Francisco. He said, Rossley, I haven't prepared anything. He said, inshallah, it'll be okay. You see the look of worry on his face. But, okay, so I get up there, I'm unprepared. I give him this 5-minute, contorted summary of things as best as I can recall. I really hadn't absorbed it yet, the whole experience. And then I get done, and I step away from the, and then the master of ceremonies makes another supplication and prayer, and then recites a little bit more of the Quran, and then adjourns the meeting. And then I get down, I step off the stage, it's about 2 feet off the ground, I step off the stage, hit the ground, and every brother in the place, all 200 or something of them, converge on me. And it felt like it was Gandhi, converged on me. You ever see the movie Gandhi? The crowds all around him. That's the way it felt. People grabbing, touching. That's the way it was. They were touching my head. They were kissing my forehead. They were crying. Some of them were crying. Telling me how pure I was, how wonderful I was. I knew who I was. Not much different than I was the day before. I was freaking out, They were giving me that Islamic triple hug. I had never been hugged by a man in my life. Really. Not even my dad, we're Germans. Even my mom really hugged me. This is not about touchy-feely people. I was in San Francisco, for God's sake. Standing there like, what's going on? Is this the correct community? They were writing their names and addresses on pieces of paper and sticking them in my pocket. Every pocket was puffed, and I looked like the scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz. took me 2 hours to get out of that room. The door was only 40 feet away. By the time I finally made it through the crowd and got over there, and I had like 30 rides offering me a ride all the way back to San Francisco. By the time I got over there, 2 hours had passed. Well, you know, the interesting thing about it was is that I was not the only speaker that night. There was another convert who also presented his recent conversion story. But he got like 8 handshakes, got off the stage, was out of there in 3 minutes, and had to find a ride back to San Francisco. But the only difference I could see from me and that convert, because he was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, a fine institution, was he was black and I was white. And I was wondering, did I enter a community of racists? Now what is going on? It was devastating. That wonderful experience I just had just was so utterly tainted by the fact that that brother was totally ignored. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just ignore it. Maybe I'm reading into it something. And then, you know, it would happen time and time again. I'd be standing in the mosque one day talking to an American brother converted to Islam from African American heritage. And the brothers would come up and shake my hand and ignore him. Or walk right out. One time in the masjid in Lawrence, Kansas, liberal environment, Rush Limbaugh said that, what do you call it? It's like a liberal oasis, and he meant it in a bad sense, in the middle of George Bush country. But I'm standing up giving the khutbah, and then I finally asked the brother, I told him we had a problem in this regard, and I said, I'll give you an example. How many of you know the American converts in our community? All the brothers seemed confident they did. So I said, raise your hand if you know Brother Jeffrey Lang. They all smiled. And how many of you know Brother Douglas? They laughed. Brother Eric? They laughed. They held up their hand. How many of you know Brother Kareem? Who's Kareem? How many of you know Brother Nathan? Nathan? Kevin? How many of you know Brother Malik? Malik? Paul? They didn't know. There were 4 African-American brothers, students at the university who attended every Friday prayer practically since they were there. The American converts, to be honest with you, their attendance was much more sporadic, the white American converts, the Caucasians. Yet they all knew them, but didn't know them. Now I know I believe it's not what I initially thought it was, deep-seated racial violent hatred. Because some of the brothers who came up to Japan, they were darker than the brothers, the African-American brothers. It wasn't that. It was something, I don't know, an experience of colonialism or the fact that Caucasian Europe is always seen as a perennial nemesis, and when one of these comes over, they think it was some sort of victory or things like that. But the point of it is, it's the reaction among us who grew up here is visceral again. We went through that kind of racism. When I grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, we were warring in the streets. Many of us who came to Islam came because we sensed that something was better. We read the Quran. We go to our community and think, here we go again? Because even if it isn't really based, somebody, every time I bring this up, comes up to me and says, it's not racism, it's just that you see, because when a white person converts, it's rare, and so we think that, you know, they can do much to bring, it doesn't matter. Maybe who cares what the reason is, or the rationale? The point is that it's destructive, and it's going to eventually lead to the kind of racial antagonism and animosity that we live through and are still living through. The scars are still fresh, they're still bleeding in the United States of America. I hope it's not a problem here in Canada. But it's just an example. You know, but the other kinds of ethnocentrism and racial stuff is
you know, racism, or not racism, but ethnocentrism is a big, big problem for our converts, for our homegrown Muslims. Okay, so if you'll allow me, I'm going to talk, unless you're exhausted. Okay, so if you'll allow me, I'm going to talk, unless you're exhausted. I'm going to talk 15, 20 minutes. Is that okay? It's okay? I'm going to talk 15, 20 minutes for some things, just some pointers. I don't have all the answers. This is going to take a collective effort. Things we need to do, start addressing the problem of massive homegrown alienation from the Muslims. And these are suggestions. First of all, of course, I mentioned the importance of scholarship that is conversant, not just with traditional Islamic sources, but also with the vast amount of Western scholarship that is coming out. We need young people that are superior in that kind of work. And it's happening. We're starting to get it. We need more. We need to make our voices heard. And we need, and it, you know, not to go in there with a chip on your shoulder or anything, just become good scholars. But, awesome. I wanted to mention a proposition that I think we can discuss in a moment. And I think you'll agree with me basically, generally, on this. It's not, it's like a meta-theorem. It's not always true, but it's more, most often true. And the theorem is this. The greater the number of practices and beliefs that we insist are essential to Islam, that we identify with Islam, this is Islam. Islam requires this. And you hear it all the time. Even though there might be very vigorous debate among the scholars right now in the Muslim community about a particular thing, you'll hear whoever happens to take this position or that position say, this is Islam. Even though they haven't really read, even though they haven't studied this objective, thorough, scholarly manner, they promote it as Islam. But what I'm trying to say is the greater number of practices and beliefs that we claim, or we insist, are demanded by Islam, the fewer will be the number of people who will consider Islam as a religious option. This goes for children growing up here, recent converts, potential converts, non-Muslims who encounter the community. Are you following me? Let me give you a quick example. When I first became a Muslim in 1982, you may agree with some of what I'm saying, you may disagree with some of it. Just to give you an example. The first few weeks, first few months I was a Muslim, it seemed like every Muslim I met was only too eager to share with me something he or she felt was, not, leave out the she, he felt was demanded by the religion, even though it was probably tenuously linked to it. There was no direct or powerful or overriding evidence, or it wasn't like there was unanimity among the scholars, past and present. For example, I was told, some of this was 1982, our community has grown up a little, so some of this is going to seem maybe a little funny, but I was told that I must wear Middle Eastern clothing. I was told that's sunnah, and you have to wear Middle Eastern clothing if you want to be a good Muslim. I was told that I can never listen to any music of any kind. I was told that I must make all my supplications in Arabic. I remember saying to them, what? God, not understand English? I was told that I must not whistle, that I must not use utensils when I eat, but I have to eat with my hand, right hand, cannot have a television, cannot wear a tie, because it looks like a cross, must overthrow the American government when the first opportunity arrives. Actually, that one's probably okay. No, look, I'll never get back in the country. Probably send me to Syria. The women cannot leave their house without their husband's permission. There were a whole ton of women ones. Women can't vote. Women can't work outside the home. Islam says that women can't drive. I was told that Islam forbids democracy, that Islam demands that I change my name to an Arabic one, even though Bilal and Salman al-Farsi are non esteemed non-Arab Muslims with non-Arabic names, and the Prophet, peace be upon him, never complained about that, that targeting civilians is permissible in jihad, and so forth and so on and on and on and on. And you know, if I hadn't read the Quran before becoming a Muslim, and go through that amazing experience, I would have left the religion just from the utter confusion of it all. All of this and much, much more was told to me is demanded by Islam. And the Quran warns us about that. It says, have you considered what provisions God has sent down? I'm roughly translating in English. And how you made some of it haram and some of it halal? You made it haram and halal. In the Quran, the burden of proof is on the person who makes it haram. Because everything is halal without divine evidence, in the Quran, according to the Quran. But, you know, time and time again, brothers say, that's haram, that's haram, that's haram. Young people email me. So many things are haram in this religion. Is anything halal? And then the verse says, say, has God indeed permitted you to do this, or do you invent a lie concerning Allah? In the Quran, inventing a lie concerning Allah is a big deal. When the Quran speaks about shirk, it doesn't just mean associating other beings as partners with God. If you read those, I looked up every instance of the use of the word shirk or the verb sharaka in the Quran, and much of it is about people who associate their own whims or fancies with God. It's a major problem, because that's how you destroy a religion. That's how you destroy a religion, because it builds a barrier between the potential spiritual seeker and whatever truths you might be trying to share. So when I first was interested in Islam, when I was a graduate at Purdue, I was talking to my friend Muhammad, who was from the Middle East. He was also a graduate student in mathematics. I said to him, Muhammad, the issue of women, and we got talking about that, and adultery, and finally he said to me, Jeff, you got to understand something. In Islam, it's bad for a man to commit adultery. But it's much, much worse for a woman to commit adultery. I said, is that in Islam? He said, yes. And I told him, well, that shows you that a man or men invented your religion. And I just wasn't interested in talking about Islam anymore. But things changed later. After I met a Muslim woman, another graduate student. No, I didn't end up marrying her. Having a relationship with her. But she was very devout. She came to me for tutoring. We started to discuss the religion. And I started to reconsider, you know, maybe taking a look at the Quran. And then later on, I actually did. But in any case, the Quran also says, and say not for any false thing your tongue puts forth. This is halal and this is haram. Be very careful. So that you do not invent a lie, so that you do invent a lie against God by doing that. And I have many other references of that form, but I don't want to exhaust you with it all. I'll just give you this example. We Muslims believe we have a message to share. We don't convert because God says he's the only one that, you know, guides somebody to Islam eventually or not, to surrender. But we have an obligation to share, especially when people are seeking. But let's pretend this is our potential audience. Let's pretend this is United States and Canada, the Canadian and American population. And we're Muslims and we're trying to represent our faith in America. And then we start telling people what the religion demands and doesn't demand. And let's say we say Islam demands that and requires that we believe that there is no God but the one God. Actually, some people are going to have a problem with that. You know, oh, I don't know. Monotheistic religions are very chauvinistic, they're violent, etc. No, we're going to lose some there. We need to be more tolerant. Yeah, we'll lose some.
Are we going to soft pedal that idea? No, because universal agreement among Muslims, we all understand that that's the requirement of the religion. And then we tell people, for example, Islam requires that you, what, pray 5 times a day. Oh, going to church once a week is already too much. Pay zakat. Oh, I pay taxes. Come on, give me a break. Fast the whole month of Ramadan. Are you kidding? You've got to be joking. Make the pilgrimage to Mecca. Terrorists, no. Even though we're losing part of our potential audience because we represent those things, we feel obliged to because we agree that the religion demands it. And then we tell them, well, there's no drinking or, you know, alcohol or drug, recreational drug use, so there goes most of it. Sex outside of lawful marriage, and there goes the rest, right? But we feel that the religion requires. And we're not going to stop peddling, even if this were to go away entirely. But when we tell people that you know, women can't drive, or that you can't wear a tie, or women must always be strictly secluded from men, all types of music are haram. You can target civilians in jihad. You know, you can just go on and on. You know, you can't have this. This is haram. That's haram. That's haram. Eventually, what happens is, you lose them all, including our children and our conduct. It becomes too much. They burn out. And the problem is, brothers and sisters, it's my feeling, and you could say I'm wrong, but my feeling is the biggest barrier between Islam and the United States and Canada, the message of Islam in the United States and Canada, especially when it comes to our children's conflicts, but even beyond that, it's not the Jewish lobby. It's not even the media. Sorry to say, it's us. Because when we do those things, we erect barriers between the faith and the seekers. What happens is we become an argument against Islam. We do. I'm dealing with these young people, dealing with these converts, and communicating with them, 95% of the time their problem with Islam is not necessarily with Islam, but with things that are very questionable. And we're losing them. I mean, how often have you heard a Muslim say, you know, I believe it should be this way, but others in, you know, other in the community see it this way, other scholars see it this way, this is my opinion, I think this is the way it should be. No. Every Muslim that's an imam, you know, Islam demands this. This is haram in Islam. This is the way Islam is. It regardless of what it is. Unless you've really studied something, done a considerable amount of research, just back off a little and say, I think, or I feel, or this is what I was taught, or this is what I know. Don't shut the door unnecessarily, because you might be shutting the door on a person when you could be wrong, or there could be difference of opinion, or you could just be totally off base. That's a major problem. There's other things we should do, but I'm running out of time. I'll just list them quickly. Our mosques should be more open to discussion. Many of them should be more democratic. Many of them are run like dictatorships. Jamaat should be more tolerant, accommodating, inclusive. It should encourage activism and participation. And we should be practical in our approach to the next generation and the surrounding population. When you become a Muslim in this community, people expect you to fit whatever their particular mental model is of the ideal Muslim right from the start. And our kids are up against it. The converts, they have a lot they're dealing with. When the Prophet, peace be upon him, sent Mu'adh bin Jabal to take over the dual governorship of Yemen, he was sort of a religious advisor there. He said, when you go there, first teach them that there is no God but God, and that Muhammad, peace be upon him, is his prophet. Well, he didn't say peace be upon him, but he said Muhammad is his messenger. He said, when they have really understood that, then teach them that there are five prayers daily. And then when they have gotten that down, then teach them, and took them one by one through the five pillars of Islam. Somebody comes into a masjid, new? Oh, you gotta drink with those. Put this. I remember a young lady came to the masjid to learn about Islam in San Francisco. Immediately, a brother got a huge blanket. She's talking to me. We're talking about, you know, the oneness of God, the beauty of self-surrender, and lo and behold, the brother is I look at him and go, she turns around and she sees him go like this. Reasonable. People open in the door, get them in the audience and talk to them. Don't drive them away. That's priorities. Prioritize things. You know, but we want our kids to walk in as if they've grown up in Cairo. It's not going to happen. You have to be patient. You know, when the and it happened during the lifetime of the Messenger of God, alayhi salam, when, you remember, this is one of my favorite hadith. You know, you've got this Bedouin sitting in the mosque one day, and he suddenly realizes he needs to relieve himself. So he stands up, walks a few paces, and urinates in the mosque. The companion's reaction was so quick. The next line says, and then the prophet said to them, peace be upon him, let go of him. That's how quick they were on top of him. Let go of him. And then he tells one of the companions, get some water. He didn't tell the Bedouin. He tells one of the companions, get some water and pour it over. You were not sent to make things hard upon me. You were sent to make things easy, he tells them. Our communities, those kids come into the mosque, the carpets come into the mosque. We expect perfection from day one. So, I mean, you add that to the fact that so much is being promoted that's tenuously linked in religion, or where there's alternative, credible points of view out there, that so much is being promoted as essential to religion, we are just herding people away. In any case, brothers and sisters, I'm writing a fourth book that deals with some of these subjects in more detail, but I don't pretend to be a scholar of fiqh or anything. Just Muslim parent, observing what's happening to our children, trying to share that point of view with you. I thought it would be obvious, but then why aren't we doing it? So I thank you for your time, and may the peace and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.